We discourage people from becoming Jewish. And, you know, you read the books of certain converts, how amazed they were that we didn't welcome them with open arms. I mean, when they first showed interest, which is completely unlike any religion. If the person is really sincere, so then we will permit him and we'll instruct him. And that's because conversion has to be based upon absolute commitment to being Jewish. Unfortunately, it's been watered down. That's a big problem with Judaism in this day and age, where conversion, to all intents and purposes, has lost its basic original meaning. And it's not just among the non-Orthodox. It's a big problem in the Orthodox community as well. But we do have an obligation. I don't want to use the word proselytize because it has a bad implication. We do have an obligation to notify, to teach Gentiles about the Torah, because the Torah is for Gentiles as well as for Jews. And that is that the Jews have been commanded to keep the 613 commands, and the Gentiles are commanded to keep the 7 Noahide laws and to follow that system. That's, we would use the word mandatory, I guess. That is mandatory for all, for mankind. The Torah is really God's revelation for all of mankind. The Jewish people has its system. The non-Jewish people, it's an amazing concept. We do not believe that everybody has to be Jewish. It's an interesting question. What about in the Messianic times? There's some, you know, controversy about that. Maybe we'll get around to it someday. It's my belief, however, I'll tell you right now, it's my belief based upon the Rambam that in the Messianic era there'll be universal peace and brotherly love and all of that, but we do not maintain that everybody will be Jewish. We do not. That's. There are others, perhaps, that have a different interpretation. I'm very convinced that it's not the case. But everybody will follow the Torah, because the Torah, as I'm trying to point out to you, is not just the 613 commandments. The Torah is divine revelation. It's a philosophy of life. It's a way of life. It's a system which you can extrapolate that way of life. You can live the way of life, the lifestyle of Torah, even if you don't keep the commandments. But whenever I say that, I have to say, not if you're Jewish, though. We have a covenant with Hashem. And the Jews entered into a covenant with Hashem to observe the mitzvos, the 613 commandments, in accordance with the interpretation that God gave down to Moshe Rabbeinu, and we call that the oral law. That is our responsibility, that's our obligation. Of course, each person to the best of their ability. I'm not, that's something else. Nobody's perfect. Nobody, there's no such thing. Even Moses sins, that's part of the Torah. And we have tshuva. That's why God gave us tshuva. But all of Israel has a share in the world to come. All of Israel has a share in the world to come. But provided they're part of Israel. I gave that last year. What makes you part of Israel? But, so nobody's perfect. If a person has certain fundamentals, certain basics, so you try to, your best, you try to achieve a higher level, obviously. And there's reward and punishment. Rambam says, even if a person accepts the what he calls the 13 principles, we did that last year. That's very important to study and to review, because it's not a bad deal. Let's put it that way. It's not a bad deal if you study them and you accept them, you affirm them, you acknowledge them, then you're quote unquote Jewish. That completes your Jewishness. Of course, you're Jewish by birth, or you're Jewish by conversion. Well, a true convert, accepts the principles. He can't. We should not permit anybody to convert if they don't intend to keep Judaism. A Jew, by birth, that's something else. But he's not. The holiness of the Jew is fulfilled when he accepts the 13. Then he says, even if he should be a sinner, even if he's a sinner, there's an amazing, I would guess, call it leniency. In that sense, that is, there's different degrees of the world to come. By the way, the Rambam's conception of the world to come was one of the areas where the whole controversies between the Rambam and the other approaches, there was a lot of opposition to the Rambam's formulations, because he was a philosopher and he applied reason and rationality to every area of Judaism. So there was a lot of opposition. One of his one of the areas was his formulation of the ultimate reward, his concept of the ultimate reward. And however, he does say that all of Israel has a share in the world to come, and there's different degrees. That's something that I'm sure many people aren't aware of. That maybe most people think either I'm in or I'm out. It's an either-or situation. Either you go to heaven or you're out of heaven. But it's not that simple. There's different degrees of heaven. That's a profound idea. How can there be different degrees of heaven? But he says all of Israel has a share. That is to say that a person is punished for their sins, but they have a share in the world to come. They're not cast away. And a Gentile, however, a righteous Gentile, that is someone who keeps the seven Noahide laws, has a share in the world to come. Now, what's the nature of the share? Like anything else, it depends on his level. He can elevate himself to a higher and higher level. It's my contention, and I think that many, you know, people would disagree with me on this. That it's my contention that it is very possible for a Gentile to obtain a higher share than a Jew in the world to come. I mean, given, that is to say, a Jew who's not on a very high level of Jewish observance is on a low level. Not all Jews are perfect. And there's different levels. Some are more perfected, some are less perfected. No matter what your denomination, that's not the point. And there are Gentiles who are on an extremely high level. So that's the way it works. It's not, I think many people have this sense of, I don't think people in this audience have that sense, maybe some do, I don't think mostly, of an innate superiority, that Jews are somehow superior to other people. I reject that notion. I don't believe in that, that there's any innate superiority. We do maintain that the Torah system is God's system, and whoever lives by it, it's the best system to live by to elevate yourself, but just because you're Jewish doesn't necessarily make you a better person. And as I said, just a person can be a non-Jew. He grapples with the issue of should he convert or not. He grapples with the issue. I had a discussion with him afterwards. He was pondering it. He wanted to know the criteria. How should I make this decision? And we discussed it. But I think it was very, very edifying. I think it must have been a surprise for many people to encounter someone who has not converted to Judaism, and values Judaism, treasures Judaism, study of Torah. He took a week off and spent a week in New York with his friends in yeshiva. He was in my class studying Torah. Okay, if there's any particular questions.
What are the seven laws you mentioned? What are the 13 laws you mentioned?
Well, the 13 principles, I can't go into that right now. That was last year's course. I can't even list them. It's a basic, I can show you, it's in the it's in every prayer book. Basically, the appropriate belief in God, that God is not physical, and so on, belief in divine revelation, that the Torah is eternal, okay, the world to come, resurrection, okay, reward and punishment. That's the basic beliefs, the fundamental beliefs. Just very quickly. Okay. I'm going to proceed now. We're going to continue where we left off. We left off with the, I gave a brief outline of the Judaism, what I call Maimonidean Judaism. Which essentially is the rational approach, that the Judaism is truth, Judaism is knowledge, it's based upon ideas, and the real, it's, when a person studies it properly and penetrates, he'll discover the truth, the ideas. It's a very unique religious system. There's no religious system like it. And that's the real task. The real task of an individual is to practice the commandments, of course, to practice the commandments. But he's got to use his mind. He's got to study. That's why the study of Torah is the most important thing. The more one probes, the more one discovers the truths that lie behind. Each mitzvah represents fundamental truths, as the Rambam says. And to simply, you know, blind obedience, to just do the activities without any type of an understanding is really not, you got to elevate yourself. That's basically what he's saying. That's not a religious idea. A religious individual is simply obedient. He does the ceremonies. They may have no meaning whatsoever. That's the idea of most religious people. That's it. I did it. I don't have to think about it. What difference does it make? I did the commandment. Whatever you commanded me to do, if I do it, I get rewarded. If not, I get punished. That's not Maimonidean Judaism. Maimonidean Judaism is that the entire purpose of fulfilling them of keeping them is to be elevated by them, because they contain profound truth, so you have to use your mind. Each one according to his own level, as I said. Also, the essence being wisdom, the knowledge, and the idea of the respect that the Rambam has for all knowledge. And that a person is supposed to study. The idea that it's a terrible thing or a negative thing or a dangerous thing to open your mind and to study. The Rambam was a master of all the wisdoms. He was one of the greatest thinkers of all time, but he mastered every area of knowledge. And you all know that he was one of the most outstanding doctors of the time. You know that. He was the physician to the Sultan in Egypt. And he was self-taught. He studied medicine by himself. He mastered everything, every area. And he was one of the most renowned physicians of his time. Now, in my opinion, what happened to the philosophy of the Rambam? The Rambam's presentation, he presented a philosophy. And it's scattered through all of his writings. Most significant is the one called The Guide for the Perplexed. Okay? You've heard of the Mora Nevuchim, The Guide for the Perplexed. All right? This is an important book. It's not the kind of book you can sit down and read on a weekend getaway. It's something you have to spend your entire life with. Okay? And even so, I mean, I've been studying, not just particularly, my first one I can't use anymore. It's going to fall apart. I just have it, in some, in a covering, whatever, just that's it. All marked up, and if I open it up, it'll probably all the pages will fall apart. I used to carry it around with me. And then this one's also beginning to wear out. But the point being, it's because I will not understand everything in this work. There are sections that he wrote it in a specific way. We'll soon find out. He wrote it in a certain way. He camouflaged a tremendous amount, because this too was a very daring maneuver. Because there are certain points in Judaism that were intended to remain secret. And this is sort of, today we're going to be concluding the study of the Rambam. We're going to get into the development of the so-called non-rational approaches, mainly the whole thing with Kabbalistic approaches, a completely different direction, a completely different formulation of Judaism. So suffice it to say that the Rambam, in spite of all of his greatness and in spite of the comprehensive philosophy that he formulated, as I said, this book you study slowly but surely. I mean, there's things that maybe I understand now that last year I couldn't understand. It's an evolutionary phenomenon, because that's just the profundity of it. And there are things here that I don't think I'll ever understand. He wrote it that way. And if you're meritorious, whatever it is, you can understand another passage, and it's a tremendous insight. But you have to study it all your life. What happened to the philosophy of the Rambam? Did it win the day, so to speak? Did it become triumphant? Did it become the centerpiece of Jewish practice? The answer is no. The answer is no, he did not. And there was a tremendous battle called the Maimonidean controversy, which raged. It was a very, very severe theological battle. Theological battles tend to be that way. The Jews are warriors too. Fortunately, we haven't had. It did come to points where it was very, very dangerous, and it did lead to book burnings. There was a major book burning of the Rambam's works, which was contributed to by his enemies. So this got very, very serious. Theological issues, and with regard to the world at large, I mean, most of the wars have been fought over theological issues. Jews didn't have those kinds of wars generally. It was heated debates with putting people, excommunications, things of that sort, denunciations, but it didn't really lead to physical warfare, except it got really nasty when it came to a point where they actually turned over the Rambam's works. Denounce them. Whenever Jews denounce other Jews to the authorities, it's a terrible, terrible thing. It's one of the worst sins. You know that. It's called a moser, or someone who's sort of a traitor and denounces Jews to the Gentile authorities. In my opinion, it's one of the greatest tragedies that the Rambam's philosophy, his whole approach, obviously, it has to. It's a philosophy. It's an approach, and it has to be developed, updated, and so on and so forth, because there's new scientific knowledge. But it's a methodology. It's an approach. In my opinion, it clearly did not win the day. And as we will see, other philosophies have triumphed and became embedded and had a tremendous effect upon Jewish history down to this very day. And the way trying to understand how Judaism is practiced today and why we do certain things and so on and so forth, we're going to try and trace it to the roots. And I'm going to be paying, I guess, a lot of attention to the development of what's called Kabbalah. I don't mean the Kabbalah of Madonna. That's not what I'm talking about. I mean, it has some connection to historical, but that doesn't bother me. That's not what I'm concerned about. But Kabbalistic, if you take a look at your Siddur, I'm sure you all have encountered this kind of thinking. It's a way of thinking. It's a certain understanding of how to approach Judaism. You've heard, if you read in the Siddur, even in the Art Scroll Siddur sometimes, you'll look for, they'll give some explanations. Then they'll say, but by way of Kabbalistic, they'll give another thing. Like, it's a Kabbalistic explanation. You've encountered that kind of thing. The whole Hasidic movement, by the way, that was a major war. When Hasidus first came on, many of the things that are accepted today, a few hundred years ago, were not accepted. And there was major warfare, I'm sure you know about that, between the early Hasidim. When Hasidim was introduced, it was universally condemned. I'm not talking by none. Most of the Jewish establishment was Orthodox. No less a figure than the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon, who hardly ever got involved in any kind of communal issues, because he just sat and studied and wrote and studied. He was the greatest genius in the recent Jewish history, the last few hundred years. And is regarded, of course, as one of the great geniuses of all time. He condemned it. He excommunicated them. He condemned it. He was a vociferous opponent. Would not hear of it. And we'll try and find out why. But that was then. Hasidism wasn't defeated. They weren't defeated. Jewish history is funny. It's funny who wins and who loses. You know, the Misnagdim or the anti-Hasidim. And the versus the Hasidim. In a sense, in a historical sense, there was a tremendous battle. And that raged for a long period of time. In a sense, the Hasidim won, I would say. Because they're still here. They're thriving. Most people, to the contrary. I think most people look up to the Hasidim. They regard... I don't know what the people in this audience... think, but it's a tendency, they sort of regard the Hasidim as being the authentic Jews, because they look authentic. You know, because they wear the garb, and they have the beards, and you know, like, that's the real thing, you know? But, I just want to make my point over here, that the history, those who survive, that's basically the attitude. That's basically the attitude of the world with different types of movements and battles. That is, whoever is sustained, that history decides. That if this movement was sustained and was victorious, so that's it. The test of history, they've passed the test of history. My personal philosophy is that does not apply in Judaism whatsoever. There's no such thing. I don't care who's victorious. Because ultimately, only Hashem will decide. And if a movement has managed to thrive and has managed to be accepted by the Jewish people, let us say, okay? And, well, today, it's not true that all Jews are Hasidic. I think they're not the majority, but, they're thriving, let's put it that way. Even if they were to become the majority, and even if all the Jews were to whatever reason become Hasidic, that would mean absolutely nothing. Because... ultimately, it's got to be true. And if it's true, it doesn't have to be popular either. Popularity is not a test. It's absolutely meaningless as far as Judaism is concerned. I mentioned that last night. We had our annual, not our annual, hopefully it'll be annual, our first dinner, 10th year anniversary of the shul. And I mentioned about the courage of Abraham, that all of the great empires of the world, no matter how powerful they were, it's a divine promise to Abraham, they would come, they would assume power, and they would not have any durability whatsoever. But Avraham Avinu was one person, because the word Avraham is Aver, that all the world was on one side, and Abraham was on the other side. When Abraham set out on his journey, so to speak, he was the only individual in the world who had the correct idea of God, and the rest of the world was religious people, but it was idolatrous, and he fought against that. And that is the foundation of Judaism, that numbers have absolutely nothing to do with the ultimate success of perpetuation. Temporarily, you can be successful. All the great empires that rose up to destroy the Jewish people. Mark Twain writes about this. All the great empires that rose up to destroy the Jewish people, anybody would have said that there's no way that the Jews can survive. They're all gone. They've all bitten the dust, and the Jews survive. Not because we're superior, but because as far as these matters are concerned, it's divine favor. It's only those who have divine favor that can survive. And it has nothing to do with numbers. That's a fundamental principle of the Torah, especially in the stories that we're reading every week. You read about Abraham, and then you'll read about Yaakov, Yitzchak, this week about Yitzchak, that Abimelech, the mighty king, and he was they drove him away. Ultimately, they sued for peace with Yitzchak, because they recognized, they said, because we know that God is with you. And the same is true with regard to Yaakov when he encounters Esau. So Jews should never be overwhelmed. Jews should never be overwhelmed by the physical dimensions, but to the contrary, the only thing that matters is that we retain our commitment to the Torah, because then we have God on our side. And without God on our side, there's no way that we could be successful. That's a fundamental. Now, I say that because we're studying historical movements, and you might think that there was a battle, and then the establishment did try to quelch the entire movement of the Hasidus, and it would seem that the establishment was defeated. The Hasidim won the day. They did win the day. Now, I'm not saying that they're right, I'm not saying that they're wrong. I'm merely saying that there's no such thing as the test of time. It's meaningless. What determines will be the truth. And we may not know the outcome at this present time. But the outcome, there will come a time when the outcome will be known, which is the correct path of Judaism. Now, getting back, we want to move on. I outlined for you the fundamentals of the Rambam's view. And you probably can see where it clashes. Where, let's just pick a couple of areas where the view of the Rambam clashes with the fundamentalist view. Does anybody have any ideas? For example, the whole foundation of the Rambam, that it's based upon the mind. Should religion be based upon the mind, or is religion based upon the heart? Is it based upon faith? It's a matter of faith, and matters of faith have nothing to do with the mind. That is one of the fundamental clashes in all of religious history. But the Rambam, it's not just the Rambam, by the way. I don't want you to think it's just the Rambam. There was other great medieval Jewish philosophers who had the same approach. For example, Sadia Gaon, Yehuda Halevi, and others. I don't mean to say it's just the Rambam. But there were individuals who were representative of what I'm terming the rational approach. So basically, isn't that a scary thing? What religion is maintaining that it's based upon knowledge? That you have to use your mind and you have to affirm the Creator with your mind to the best of your ability, but therefore it means you have to have a certain understanding. If you study through study, not just blind faith is absolutely rejected by the Rambam. And there are different ways to study nature. If you study nature, the heavens declare the glory of God, to arrive at a conviction through an awareness of the wisdom, the infinite wisdom that we see around us, that this has to come from a source. But there's also, of course, it's not just that, but we have the revelation. And the revelation of Judaism is very, very unique. It's different than in any other religion due to the fact that it was a public phenomenon. So one should study history. That's what the Torah tells you, to study the history of the world. Has any nation, has this occurred to any nation? Has an entire nation been gathered together and witnessed what you yourselves have witnessed, what this nation has witnessed and has been passed down from generation to generation? And so on. So, I would say the major area of a clash would be one of them. That for the religious personality, it's all based upon faith. It's based upon faith. And to a certain extent, for a number of reasons. Let me tell you a number of reasons why. And then there's good reasons too. I mean, there's two sides over here. There's reasons why one could be suspicious of reason. People are afraid to base it on reason because reason is always doubt. It's always, you're questioning. When you're questioning, it's always open to doubt. But faith is unshakable. Many people feel that way. That's unshakable. If you have faith, and that's it, you close your mind. And that's no matter what happens, if you have faith, that's it. But if you don't, you're using your mind. So today you may be convinced this way, tomorrow you could change your mind. That's one of the arguments. I mean, I don't accept it. That's a good argument only if the appropriate way to relate to God is through closing your mind. But if not, if the appropriate way is through using your mind, so then maybe there's risks. Yeah, there's risks. But that's the reality. There's always risks. What can you do? I don't think anybody would use that approach in a different area. It'd be nice to have a sense of certainty when it comes to if a person has an illness. It would be nice to have a certain sense of certainty that this is the right treatment. So therefore, though, I don't want to think, don't tell me anything. But we say that's ridiculous because the only way to know if there is you have to use it. You have no choice. And if you use your mind, we all know that, then sometimes there's doubt. There's going to be doubt. Anytime you're involved in any project, there's going to be doubt. But what else do I have but my mind? So at the end of the day, I have to do the best of my ability, grapple with the choices, and make a choice. The other areas was this, again, the dimension of faith. There's another point to mention over here. And that is that for some people, faith is a virtue. It's a virtue. And that is that I don't question. And in spite of the fact that I don't have any proof, I still have faith in God. It sounds crazy. I mean, to me it sounds crazy. I don't know how it sounds to you. But according to that, you're sort of better off being in doubt. You're sort of better off not knowing. Because if you don't know, then you have a pure faith. But the more you know, so what's the big deal? That is an argument, I think, that affects a lot of people. That if you know, so then what's the special? You know. I don't agree with that because, again, you see from the Torah seems to indicate, to the contrary, that the more knowledge one has, the more perfected one is. Because, for example, who had the greatest knowledge of God, for example? Oh, you had the Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, but Moses. There was no man, Asher Yido, Hashem, that God related face to face, so he had the greatest. It would turn out that if blind faith is the real virtue, and that's because you're great, you have faith, even though you don't know, that argument, so then it will turn out that someone like Moses wasn't on a high level, because he knew, and he had no doubts whatsoever. So it would mean that according to that, a person should cultivate a state of ignorance. Which of course is contrary, my understanding, it's contrary to the Judaism. So the man of faith is very suspicious of learning, of knowledge. He's concerned that it might upset the basic, fundamental, simplistic belief in the Creator. Again, this is my opinion. I don't think that's a Jewish view. I personally regard that as being a non-Jewish view. I think that's more of a Christian approach. They're very, very suspicious of knowledge to the extent that one of the theologians said, creo que absurdo, that to, I believe because it's absurd, that's a virtue, to cultivate faith. And our concept of faith, we have a concept of faith. But the foundation of that faith has to be the knowledge of the person. You can't take away a person's mind. If you take away a person's mind, that's his essence, that's his divine soul, that God gave him choice, and God gave him the ability to conceptualize, to think, to study, to understand, and using that tool, through that tool, you'll recognize the Creator. That's the highest level. So to tell a person to close his mind and just believe, it's akin to idolatry, as far as I see it. I know that's harsh language. But I got to tell you what I think. But I'm telling you, there's other views. I'm not, you know, I'm just trying to give you a description. You encounter that. Fundamentalism, too. You've encountered a certain fundamentalist personality who's very religious, but he's closed-minded. And another aspect of the fundamentalist is a certain type of a literalism. You see, there was, by the way, there was good, in this whole conflict, I'm not going through all the history and the battles. That's just details you can read about this. There was, I don't mean to just to paint one side against the other. Mistakes are made usually on both sides, with the protagonists. There are dangers with the Rambam approach. You have to understand that. There are dangers. Because people, you know, in the wrong hands, people begin to rationalize everything away. Once you rationalize, so it can lead to a weakening of one's observance. Because the person thinks, he knows, oh, I know what that is, I understand the reason, so I don't do it this way, I do it the other way. I'm observing. Once you've got to be very, very careful. And the Rambam, well, of course, he was a great individual, and his understanding and his commitment to keeping the mitzvot. When you give these things over to students, it does become dangerous. I mean, people have to know how to use their mind. They have to have certain, you know, they have to have the correct training. They have to have certain restraints. And I've seen, you see the dangers of people that become, sometimes they become very haughty. They think they're such geniuses. But very often it leads to has led to a diminishing. People can be very lax then about the actual performance of the mitzvos. And they just all I have to do is really understand and then use the mind and study and then whatever. And it becomes more of an intellectual phenomenon, but it can lead to a weakening of Judaic practice. So there are concerns, there's no question about it. But there's something else I want to convey. A couple of things I want to convey, the flavor of the debate, if I can. See, the essence of the religious person, the essence of the... I hope you know what I mean by these terms, because, you know, these are terms I pretty much coined myself. So how would you know what I mean? But you know what I mean. There's such a thing like a religious personality. You know what I'm talking about? And there's such a thing as a philosophical personality. Someone whose essence is ideas and wants to understand that it's got to make sense. And it's painful. I mean, I consider myself that type of a person. That I keep the Torah 100%. I believe 100% in the Torah. But I believe that the essence of the Torah is wisdom and knowledge. And when I hear somebody get up and talk about a mitzvah and what the significance of this mitzvah is and what it does and it creates forces in the world, it's stuff which makes me ill. When I hear people explaining the Torah, I have an allergy. It makes me sick. If somebody gives, I mean, no one's perfect, and you can give a bad explanation, that's all right. But I could see that it's an explanation. But sometimes it's such silliness. And it just doesn't, or you're just positing certain things, and this is a holy, and this, that, without explaining what you're talking about, without translating it into terms that make sense. The Torah has to make sense at the end of the day. And try your best. We try our best. Okay, that's something else. You know, we agree, we disagree, I don't like this. I, a lot of times I'll hear a speaker, and I may not agree with him, but he said something. He said something, he approached it. You can see the respect for the subject matter. But then there's a lot of ideas that no thinker would accept them. But to a religious person who feels a certain way, they're very good, he's very satisfied. Because he's not searching for a truth. I don't know if you've experienced this. Maybe you're not attuned. I'm attuned to it. And I just cringe. It just bothers me because, you know, it's the meaning of Torah. Torah is from Hashem. Hashem came down on Sinai to teach us that? To teach us something which is silly? that anybody, a lot of people do it in different ways. They'll project their own idea about something, and they'll say that's what the Torah is really saying. It's superficial. The Torah is not superficial. Not if you believe that it's from Sinai, not if it's a divine. The Rambam has a rebuke, I read it last night too. Rebuked about this individual who asked a good question and about certain aspects of creation, the story of the first sin. That's the first major chapter in the Mora. And the Rambam comes to the most profound ideas. In that chapter, he comes to the most profound ideas as a result of this question. But the questioner, preemptively, you just assumed. He came to some very superficial conclusions, and the Rambam starts off by castigating him. That you're showing a basic disrespect for the Torah, that you just jump to the first. You can't study the Torah like you're reading a newspaper or something like that. That's something which is very, very important. That's something that's really, really lacking in the world today, among all the groups, Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform. It's a failure to respect the Torah. I just want to give you a sense of what the Rambam, this is how the Rambam viewed his opponents, so to speak. It conveys, in the section, he has a section on the Divine Commandments. And I'll just read the words to you, and maybe it'll ring, you'll have a certain understanding, that this is a deep-seated thing, that these things, these divides, are very, very deep, they're very, very rooted in the psyche, and there are some people that have a certain religious approach by nature, and it's an anti-philosophical. To a certain extent, you might say it's a hatred for a philosophical. They want it to be irrational. That gives them satisfaction. They want it to be mysterious. And if you try and take a mitzvah and explain to them that it's not a mysterious thing, but there's very concrete reasons that I can show it to you and how it helps your life, and an intelligent person would have come up with this idea too if he had such wisdom. They're going to kill you. They don't want it. They do not want it to be... I've had this experience myself when I would give classes sometimes to show the foundation of Torah Sinai. How do we know that Torah is from Sinai? Do we have any kind of evidence for this? Do we have any kind of reason to believe? Or is it just faith? And you can see that the most religious people have a tremendous aversion. They don't want to hear it. They want it not to be provable. They want it to be in the realm of just belief. And the nerve to take something like that and to show that this is, you can prove through certain historical proofs that it really happened, you're taking it out of the realm of something which is religious and belief, and you're making it into something concrete. So they said to me, I mean, when I first encountered that, I couldn't believe it. Wouldn't you be thrilled? You believe in this? Wouldn't you be thrilled if someone could show to you that what you've been believing all your life, I can show you that it's really true? No, when I discovered those things, and when they were taught to me, I was filled with great joy. Because before that, I had doubts. I kept it, whatever reasons, but once, if you can remove a doubt, and you can prove that what I believe in is real, objectively now, I don't have to believe, I have knowledge, that's the greatest thing in the world. Yeah, that's one approach. The Rambam maintained that every mitzvah, every commandment in the Torah has a reason, a benefit, a reason, and there's no such thing as a mysterious mitzvah. Now, we may not, there are mitzvahs, for example, they're called the statutes, chukim. There are mitzvahs that we may not, that are for very advanced people, not everybody will discover the reason. As he quotes the Gemara, that the red heifer, you know, the red heifer, that's considered to be the most complicated mitzvah to understand. And the Gemara says that King Solomon discovered the reasons for all the mitzvahs except the red heifer. That's it. He couldn't penetrate that one. And Moses discovered the reason for the red heifer. So he says, the Rambam, so you see from the Gemara that all the mitzvahs have reasons. Because otherwise, what's the discussion? So he has a whole section on the Divine Commandments. This is what he says. There are persons who find it difficult to give a reason for any of the commandments, and consider it right to assume that the commandments and prohibitions have no rational basis whatever. They are led to adopt this theory by a certain disease in their soul. The Rambam did not mince words. There was no political correctness in those days. They are led to adopt this theory by a certain disease in their soul, the existence of which they perceive, but which they are unable to discuss or to describe. For they imagine that these precepts, if they were useful in any respect, and were commanded because of their usefulness, would seem to originate in the thought and reason of some intelligent being. But as things which are not objects of reason and serve no purpose, they would undoubtedly be attributed to God, because no thought of man could have produced them. According to the theory of those weak-minded persons, man is more perfect than his creator. For what man says or does has a certain purpose, while the actions of God are different. He commands us to do what is of no use to us, and forbids us to do what is harmless. Far be this. On the contrary, the sole object of the law of the Torah is to benefit us. Thus we explain the scriptural passage, quote, "For our good always, that he might preserve us alive as it is this day." Again, quote, I quoted this to you before, "which shall hear all these statutes," the nations will hear all these statutes, "and say, surely this great nation is a wise and discerning people, and understanding people." End of quote. God thus says that even every one of these statutes, those are the ones that the reason is not obvious on the surface, even every one of those statutes convinces all nations of the wisdom and understanding it includes. Okay, so the Torah itself is saying that the nations will hear and they'll say, what a wise and discerning nation, because they'll become familiar with the mitzvahs. That's what you saw last week. That's the Sean O'Neill, who rejected religion until he was exposed to Judaism, presented in a rational way, and he said, this makes sense. So he says, continue with the Rambam, "But if no reason could be found for these statutes, if they produced no advantage and removed no evil," I mean, they're simply mysterious, and we can't find any benefit for them, but God gave them to us. "Why then should he who believes in them and follows them be wise, reasonable, and so excellent as to raise the admiration of all nations? But the truth is undoubtedly, as we have said, that every one of the 613 precepts serves to inculcate some truth, to remove some erroneous opinion, to establish proper relations in society, to diminish evil, to train in good manners, or to warn against bad habits. All this depends on three things: opinions, having correct opinions, morals, and social conduct." That's basically how the Rambam understood the problem in terms of the other side. All of this, what I'm trying to show you, is that he says it's a very deep thing. He calls it a disease of the soul. That means to say that it's something which is inculcated in a person's nature, and you have to work on that. According to the Rambam, if a person has that attitude, if he has that approach, it's a very serious religious defect. So you see, those people who today, this is very, very important, those people who today, who you encounter, and you know, I'm sure you've all encountered religious people, very, very frum is the word, very religious people, and they're so, and they never question anything, and you kind of say, a lot of times you say, well, I mean, I admire their faith. I can't have such a faith because it's, but I admire them. There is a certain kind of an admiration that people tend to feel for that type of a personality. That is someone who's absolutely close-minded and convinced for whatever, for no reason, hasn't really studied it, just has that very, very powerful emotional feeling of faith. A man of faith? I couldn't do that. I could never live like that because it doesn't make any sense to me. But I really admire this person. That's how the world looks at it. The world looks at that person as being a person, as long, I mean, unless this person is crazy. But you see how faith is a very dangerous thing. You see how the whole you have to understand this whole problem with terrorism today. Essentially, it's all faith. People don't blow themselves up. They may want to, you know, they may want to kill. No, the Nazis, communists, fascists, and all, they were terrible, terrible terrorists, but they tried to kill the other person and to escape. But no person blows himself up intentionally, happily, very, very happily. Why? Because you have to understand, the whole problem is a religious problem. Whatever, I mean, it's maybe politically correct. I mean, Bush doesn't want to say it's a religious problem. Indeed, there could be a solution, theoretically, if it's true. If it is true, this was my suggestion, which no one listened to, on how to solve the war on terror, without firing a shot. Maybe I should bring it up again. It's a religious problem. If these people were not convinced that they're going to paradise, they would never do it. Would never do it. Because the self-preservative instinct is too powerful. Nobody ever... People will commit suicide because their life is too painful. That's part of the self. It sounds crazy, but that's part of the self-preservative. Whatever a person does in their own psyche, it's determined by purely selfish criteria. It is impossible for man not to act in a selfish way. It could be a destructive way, but from a psychological standpoint, at that moment, he's doing what he feels is best. And he can't take the pain. Whatever. He wants to escape the disgrace. So whatever it is. But... therefore, so why would a person blow himself up? Why would he take an airplane and smash it into the World Trade? Why? What happened to the self-preservative instinct? You mean he doesn't care about himself? He does care about himself because they are absolutely convinced that they are going straight to heaven. And not just heaven, but it's going to be paradise, infinitely more fun. They're going to have a lot of fun there too with all kinds of sexual because they can't have it in this world. They can't. They're sexually repressed. In this world, in the world to come, the hedonists. Okay? So, that's the truth. Do you see this documentary? I just caught parts of it. I forget the name. It's about this mother, this Israeli mother, whose daughter was killed in a suicide, right? One of those, her name was Ayant? Or the Arab girl was? The Palestinian. So this Palestinian, they were pretty much the same age. The Palestinian girl was about 17, 18, whatever it is, and whatever. I didn't see the whole thing. I just caught parts of it. And this Israeli mother, I watched the play. She had this, I didn't see the whole development, but she at a certain point, she couldn't accept it. I mean, a beautiful daughter, there can't be anything more horrible. And she was on the way to, in college, she wanted to be a doctor. She was a wonderful, wonderful person. And So the mother, I guess she was meeting with this group, you know, these groups, and she got this idea that she has to meet with the mother of the killer. Mother to mother will talk. Mother, because you're a mother and I'm a mother. Well, she had to believe that we can get beyond this. There's some human level at which we can connect and get beyond this. So I didn't see the whole thing. They try to arrange a meeting, and she goes into the West Bank, but it doesn't work out. It's a whole big deal. And I'm watching it. You have to feel a certain compassion. And, I mean, I don't believe that these things can work. But let me see. So finally, the best they could do was to arrange over a television screen, you know, a television conference. Okay, and she's in Israel and the Palestinian. And they start talking, and she's mother to mother, and she's, we can get past this. And all you have to do to say that your daughter died for nothing, it was the wrong thing to do, she died in vain, what was accomplished by it? It's just destruction. And if you'll get up and you'll say that, so maybe other people will hear, other mothers, and maybe they'll stop doing it. And so what did you gain? You know, your daughter could have been this and that, and my daughter, what did I lost? You lost. Oh no, she starts going, we're occupied, you don't understand, and this and that, and she couldn't. She didn't die in vain, because every time you can see this woman who was obviously starting out with a very liberal viewpoint that we can talk. She's projecting her own emotions of goodness. She's a good person. She's projecting it onto the rest of the world. Good people have a tendency to do that. They have this need to believe that everybody's like them. Everybody has my feelings deep down. You're a mother and I'm a mother, and we can get past this thing. And You've got to feel like I feel about it. That is the biggest mistake that good people make. They project there's such a thing as, this other woman was insane, I can tell you that. She's just insane. Because she couldn't, at certain point, she's trying to get pale. She's this Israeli woman. I don't know why she didn't quit earlier. She's so frustrated. Finally, she said, I can't talk. She couldn't deal with it. She couldn't grapple with it. Don't you see that? Forget about the past. That's not going to get us anywhere. If we want to have peace, the other one wants peace. The other one wants peace. But occupation and this and that, yeah, she has peace, but according to her. So this woman is basically insane. It's an insanity. She can't get it. She can't get past it. Cannot be rational in that. Can't. She's just. And that's the whole Palestinian society. That's just the truth. There's no way. I don't see any way out of it. Any compromise, fine. Compromise for peace. But if the other person's insane, you can't make a compromise. Anyways, this is the problem. The problem is completely religious. And it's connected to this approach to religiosity. This fundamentalist approach, which is based upon these very powerful, deep-seated emotions which cannot be questioned where there's no challenging, it can lead to this kind of a situation. Now, my solution was that all of these people are doing it only because they're insanely convinced that they go to paradise. Now, the only thing that could stop them is if you could remove that belief, if you could convince them that it's not the case, that they're not going to go to paradise, and to the contrary, that they're going to go to hell. If they thought like that, if they were convinced, for whatever reason, that this is contrary, this is the most horrendous thing, and the idea that God would reward you for something so horrible. Now, how can that be? Well, get the major leaders of Islam. Now, officially they claim that they don't believe in that. That's what they claim officially. And I don't agree with President Bush that this does not reflect Islam, that they've hijacked the religion, and so on and so forth. If that's the case, then the major leader should be denouncing it, not just denouncing it, but teaching the doctrine of what causes you, because in Judaism, I can tell you you'll lose the world to come. If people embrace the horrendous doctrine, the Jew on the other side, we had one or two cases. Baruch Goldstein went berserk, and he went into the mosque and he shot up. The whole Jewish world, every rabbi, if you got up and been backed and praised them, you were in big trouble. You'd lose your job the next day, unless it's some crazy sect somewhere. Rightfully so. Every rabbi from every denomination would have to condemn it in the utmost. The idea that that activity is going to get you. The most you could say is that maybe he went over the, he went berserk, he went crazy, he wasn't responsible. But to say that doing something like that will get you into paradise. So why don't they, the way to stop this, it's a theological issue. All the leaders of Islam should get together and teach over and over and over again what it is that will cause you to lose the world to come. This will, and if that was taught in every school, in every religious school, everybody knew that if you kill an innocent person, and including Jews, and people, Israeli soldiers, that to the contrary, you can't get into heaven. Then it would never happen again. It would never happen again. I mean, you may have terrorism. I'm saying you wouldn't have terror, well, but you wouldn't have suicide bombing. There was, I'm not sure about this one. Maybe somebody has some knowledge about this one. I read this, it's a while. I haven't been, that when the British were controlling and there was insurrections from some of these terrorists, I think that they have a belief, because they have this whole thing with pig. They don't eat pig. That if you're buried in pigskin, you don't go to heaven. And I'm just saying, I think so. I'm not saying 100% that this one of the commissioners who was in charge, what he did was he would somehow or other, whatever the case was, his reprisal was it was back in those days. Today I don't know if you can get away with it. That he would sort of anyone that was caught in some kind of terrorist thing, he would have them buried in pigskin and they wouldn't go to heaven. And the whole thing is crazy altogether. But whether that's true or not, there's no doubt in my mind that the underlying cause of the problem, this particular manifestation of the problem, is religious. And it's only because of their faith which convinces them for no reason whatsoever. I mean, that's the danger of blind faith, where there's no reason whatsoever. That the infidel and the killer, however it comes together, the killing of the infidel and jihad. You have to study some of their jihad. To engage in jihad is the greatest thing. And that will earn them an eternal reward. Truth of the matter is, it's not just Islam. Throughout history, Christianity had the same, not this formulation, but the painting of the Jew, the persecution of the Jew, and anti-Semitism, which ultimately led to the Holocaust, was the product of Christianity. Christianity has gone through a big transformation in our time. It's that proves my point, by the way. But this proves my point. It's an amazing thing. It's a different story. I had prepared maybe towards the end to give a review of this phenomenon of Christian Zionism. The tremendous transformation of Christian doctrine vis-a-vis the Jew is an unbelievable thing. And they made major theological changes. Theological changes, which is I don't think anybody could have imagined that, on fundamental doctrines. Most significantly, the idea that the Jewish people has been rejected by God, and that supersession. It's called Christianity has superseded Judaism. That was the fundamental doctrine of Christianity throughout all of history, and was the basis for the persecution of the Jews. They have officially renounced that. That is the official in most of the churches, the Catholic Church, as well as most of the Protestant denominations today, have given up the idea of supersession, and they have returned to the idea that the Jews have a valid that the covenant with the Jews is a valid covenant. They don't face all the theological consequences. I'll point that out. But the idea then, this proves that historically speaking, I would have said this is impossible, given the deeply rooted character of these fundamental doctrines. But you see, it's possible, and as a result of that, the entire attitude towards the persecution of the Jews has changed, because it was all rooted in theological bases. Now, the question is that possible within Islam? Is it possible for Islam to go through a similar type of a doctrinal transformation? If that's the case, then it could lead to tremendous benefits in reducing tensions, which can lead to the world war, to the next nuclear holocaust. It could. Yet no one is, I don't know if anyone's thinking along these lines, anyone of significance, except myself, but that's, take that. I didn't mean significance. But anyways, this is, next week we'll begin the next phase, which will be the development, the introduction of the so-called Kabbalistic approach to Judaism. So see you next week. Thank you very much. Well, unless I decide to run for president, how's that? With my new approach to terrorism.